Rise. Au hea o ko e ko ka aha, inahe kuleana imua o kea, aha ho o kolo kolo ki I ke hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, I lohe I e ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho ilalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCPW-23-76, Womble Bond Dickinson, LLP, Shook Hardy and Bacon, LLP, and Covington and Burling, LLP, versus the Honorable Robert D. S. Kim, Chief Judge of the Circuit Court of the Third Circuit, et al. Arguing for the petitioners, Jeffrey Michael. Also appearing is Edmund K. Safari, Deidre Marie Iha, and Thomas J. Hughes of Goodsill, Anderson, Quinn, and Stifel. Also appearing, David M. Louie of Kobayashi, Sugita & Goda, LLP. Also appearing, Melvin M. Miyagi of Watanabe Ng, LLP. Also appearing, Lyle Hosoda of Hosoda Law Group. Also appearing, Thomas Benedict of Farm Benedict Sugihara. Arguing for the respondents, Philip Holden. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our substitute justices, Judge John Tanaki and Clarissa Molinow. Counselor, are you both ready to proceed? Yeah. All right, we've allotted 30 minutes to each side for argument. Just to confirm, Mr. Michael, you'll have 22 minutes, 8 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Holden, you'll have 30 minutes. Mr. Michael, please proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Again, it's Jeffrey Michael on behalf of the petitioners. The circuit court in this product liability case exercised personal jurisdiction over three non-resident law firms based on a theory of jurisdiction that this court has never adopted, nor, as far as we can tell, has any other court in Hawaii. Judge Kim exercised so-called conspiracy jury jurisdiction over the non-resident law firms without providing any rationale or citing any authority, let alone explaining why he was disagreeing with the considered decisions of Judges Crabtree and Deweese, each of whom dismissed these same law firms from cases with substantially identical complaints and substantially identical records. We're asking this court to reject the so-called conspiracy theory of jurisdiction. Under this court's decisions and in the interests of Doe and Shaw, and also a long line of U.S. Supreme Court cases culminating in Walden and Bristol-Myers Squibb, a defendant's own contacts with the state must be sufficient to create personal jurisdiction. And in a tort case like this, that means that the defendant itself must have purposefully targeted or purposefully directed its actions at the state. The so-called conspiracy theory of jurisdiction violates those bedrock principles by allowing a defendant to be subject to personal jurisdiction based on another party or entity's contacts. As Judge Crabtree wrote, accepting that theory of jurisdiction would greatly expand what Hawaii's appellate courts currently permit and will be a major and novel expansion of personal jurisdiction. For example, the conspiracy theory could allow a Hawaii law firm that does no work outside of Hawaii to be subject to personal jurisdiction in the mainland as far away as Maine to Florida because its clients do business in those states. Similarly, if this court doesn't reject it for Hawaii, non-resident law firms all across the mainland could be subject to jurisdiction in Hawaii, even though they've never entered the state, based on their clients doing business in the state.
Isn't this a sort of a species of agency theory, though? And our statute recognizes agency as one grounds for exercising jurisdiction, and really a conspiracy, some courts have pointed out, is an agency relationship. So it's not unfair to hold one member of the conspiracy responsible for the actions of the other, as long as that member was aware of or had reason to know those actions. What's your response to that?
My response is no, this is not a species of agency jurisdiction. First, the Hawaii long arm statute does have a prong for agency, but it nowhere mentions conspiracy jurisdiction. So what plaintiffs have said in this case is not that the law firms have an agent in Hawaii. The law firms have no agent in Hawaii. What they're saying is that the manufacturers who hired the law firms had contacts to Hawaii. But under the law, a lawyer might be an agent for his or her client. But the law firm is not the agent of the client who hires a law firm is not an agent. So
isn't that pursuant to the conspiracy? Aren't co-conspirators typically liable for the actions of others taken within in furtherance of the conspiracy, as long as it's within the objectives of the conspiracy?
That's right. That's the liability rule. But jurisdiction must be determined before liability. That's what this court said in Six Flags, and that's also, I think, a universally accepted principle by courts. It's also the case that the jurisdiction inquiry is to protect the defendant's due process rights and individual liberty rights. The attribution rule for alleged co-conspirators for liability purposes, the purpose behind that is to expand the pool of resources that a plaintiff can collect from. So I would submit it would be perverse to use a plaintiff-friendly rule in order to undermine what both this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has said is a defendant's right under due process, and also stems from the territorial limitations of a court to exercise its power.
Counsel, you know, Walden points to a defendant's acts, and it says, through an agent, as an example of one kind of relevant conduct that may subject an individual to jurisdiction. And the CJ has just mentioned sort of the analogy with our long-arm statute. So, I mean, even if conspiracy jurisdiction doesn't exactly align with agency theories, you know, can't one co-conspirator be the agent in a sense of another co-conspirator, which would mean that it is a relevant contact with the forum state?
Right. So as we said in our briefing, agency as a matter of common law and longstanding tradition, agency involves control. So if you have two alleged co-conspirators where one of the co-conspirators is in control, then conspiracy, and I think some of the cases and commentators have said this, conspiracy kind of is just a descriptive term. What you're really saying is agency because one person was an agent of the other and there was control. Here, like I said, you had clients, the cigarette manufacturers, hiring the law firms. You don't have the law firms engaging someone who they're controlling and coming into the state. It's not like, for example, an employee-employer situation.
So you absolutely reject the agency analogy.
Correct.
Let me ask you this then. You know, Walden, and you mentioned Walden, I think you mentioned Bristol-Myers Squibb and Ford. You know, Walden doesn't expressly discuss conspiracy jurisdiction. I note that the U.S. Supreme Court denied cert in the Fitch Ratings case in 2016, and just last year in 2022, the Lloyds banking case, they, you know, denied cert on a specific conspiracy jurisdiction CERDAP. And, you know, I mean, what, and Bristol-Myers Squibb and Ford don't even really talk about it at all. I mean, there's not even a glance at it. What is this silence? What can we take from the silence of the U.S. Supreme Court and, you know, avoiding a call on conspiracy jurisdiction?
Right. So, well, first, Your Honor, obviously the denial of a petition for certiorari has absolutely no authoritative value one way or another. If I recall, in the most recent one, it was the LIBOR case that had essentially every bank in the world and multiple justices had to recuse from the case. So certainly you've got a court without the full nine justices, that speaks even less to the inability to have four votes to grant cert. But the cases over the years, while Your Honor is correct, they don't specifically address conspiracy jurisdiction, have exhibited an increased focus and increased exertion on it must be the defendant's own actions that create personal jurisdiction. So for example, in Walden, the court said the relationship must arise out of the context that the defendant himself creates with the forum state, which echoes, frankly, this court's decision in Shaw, which said jurisdiction must be based on the defendant's context in Hawaii.
So, you know, given the defendant focus, and Walden actually also says the proper question is whether the defendant's conduct connects him to the forum in a meaningful way. So, I mean, clearly it's not anything goes, I guess, but, you know, say a plaintiff shows that the defendant knew that the co-conspirator was engaging in overt acts and furtherance of the conspiracy in the particular forum state, in this case, Hawaii. I mean, doesn't that knowledge, that defendant focus, comport with Walden and the rest of the line of the cases?
Well, two responses on that, Your Honor. First, as a general due process matter, no, it wouldn't. Because that's essentially saying foreseeability. The defendant should have foreseen that his or her alleged co-conspirator was going to do something in Hawaii. But foreseeability has been rejected as foreseeability of harm was rejected by this court in Shaw. You specifically said foreseeability that you're going to hurt someone in Hawaii.
But I'm not talking about stream of commerce and Asahi and all that. I'm talking about a defendant who has knowledge about the co-conspirator due to their, you know, they have a unilateral type of, you know, it's not a unilateral relationship. You have a conspirator, you have an agreement. The one conspirator knows that the other conspirator is targeting the forum state, targeting Hawaii. Doesn't that knowledge align with what Walden has said and some of the other cases have said?
Well, I would stand by my first answer, Your Honor, that would just be a species of asserting jurisdiction based on foreseeability of harm in the state. That would be an uber foreseeability. But the second response is that's simply not the facts of this case. Plaintiff had the burden under this court's longstanding precedent to be the one to prove jurisdiction exists. And again, under this court's precedent, plaintiff needed to do that with evidence, not just allegations and certainly not just statements in the brief. And if you look at the exhibits they produced, there's nothing approaching what Your Honor's hypothetical.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So let's say we did adopt conspiracy jurisdiction. Your fallback position, which is just what you just said there, is they just didn't show it. I mean, there's no ammo to really, if we were to adopt conspiracy jurisdiction, I know in their memorandum and opt to your motion, your 12B2 motion, they threw a bunch of scattered exhibits out there. Say we adopt conspiracy jurisdiction. Tell me why those scattered exhibits don't show that there's jurisdiction.
Okay, well, that is our alternative argument, and we certainly don't think the court should get there. But if the court were to take, for example, your hypothetical, so you're correct. Plaintiff came forward with exhibits that are in the record, and if you look at those exhibits, and this is laid out in our reply brief below, they approach nothing to showing what Your Honor just said. For example, for Womble, for example, 36 of the 49 exhibits don't even mention Womble. 32 of the 49 don't mention Hawaii. Only three of them have Womble and Hawaii, and if the court examines them, they're normal defense of litigation or counseling on proposed regulations. or other things that have nothing to do with this case, like secondhand smoke or environmental tobacco smoke. There's nothing in the exhibits for Shook. You can look at Covington and you can look at Womble. There's nothing in them that approaches some sort of showing of an alleged conspiracy between the clients and the law firms that they hired that would approach Your Honor's hypothetical. And that's a part of the reason why adopting conspiracy jurisdiction in this case would be so dangerous and troubling, is that the very nature of the attorney-client relationship is going to always involve some sort of counseling, advice from the lawyer. Sometimes the clients take the advice, sometimes they ignore your advice. But and this has been a point that's been made by some commentators. It's always going to be very simple to, at least at the allegation stage, to say that a law firm was conspiring with its client. And then the other respondents in this case, Philip Morris and Reynolds, made the point that just the downstream consequences of that in terms of chilling the ability to find law firms, and plaintiffs alleging then that, well, we're going to have to disqualify the law firm because they're a defendant. It's just opening a massive can of worms, frankly.
Is there any law firm that's been reeled in under conspiracy jurisdiction? I hear international banks, Ponzi schemers. I have not seen any law firms that have come under that auspices. Am I incorrect there?
Right. And of the cases that we've cited, the one I can think of is the Nevada case, the Tricarici, if I'm saying that right, where Saforth Shah was an alleged co-conspirator. There, the Nevada Supreme Court created a test for conspiracy jurisdiction and then applied that test and found that it did not exist.
And they did that post-Walden conspiracy jurisdiction, right?
Nevada, so.
As did the Utah Supreme Court, right?
Yes, as did the Utah Supreme Court. The Utah Supreme Court, though, they, if you read that decision, they first said they were doing it warily because they knew that too broad conspiracy jurisdiction, in our view, any conspiracy jurisdiction, but was going to potentially violate due process. And so they created a test that required really detailed examination of the allegations and the alleged conspiracy and the defendants, each defendant's acts within the alleged conspiracy, and said, you need to make sure that defendant's acts open them up so that they could reasonably anticipate being hailed into the jurisdiction. Of course, remanded that case.
The allegations in the complaint are that the lawyers stopped acting as lawyers and became co-conspirators. They controlled the research, identified what research should be done, establishing areas of research that weren't supposed to be performed, misdirecting the research, cultivating friendly scientific witnesses, and on and on. Your argument is that would these allegations by themselves be enough to establish a conspiracy? And, or is it are legally insufficient, or is it your argument that the actual evidence put forth doesn't back up these allegations? I'm trying to,
right.
I guess it could be both. But
right. It is both, but more the latter, Your Honor. Once we controverted jurisdiction under this court's longstanding precedent, plaintiff had the burden to come forward with evidence, not just allegations, and as I said before, not just statements in the brief. And they did that. So that was just for the sake of being clear, the Shaw case by this court and the Fisher case from the Intermediate Court of Appeals, that you need actual evidence. And they did that. They brought forward 49 exhibits for one. The exhibits largely overlap, but not completely. And almost none of the exhibits for any of these petitioners had Hawaii and the petitioners on the same documents. And the ones that did, one, for example, listed Womble as a national counsel for tobacco companies in Hawaii.
So say there was evidence to back up these types of allegations. What would the plaintiffs need to show to be able to invoke conspiracy jurisdiction in terms of the actions of the defendant with relation to Hawaii? Because if there were a conspiracy to do something far more than just providing legal representation, to literally plan out a strategy to be able to market this product despite scientific evidence to the contrary, what exactly would be required for the plaintiffs to show with regard to the law firms to be able to establish jurisdiction in Hawaii under a conspiracy theory.
Right. So under our main position, of course, Your Honor, is
no conspiracy.
No conspiracy theory. You'd need to show that, as just has been the case under this court's and Supreme Court precedent for, you know, dozens, scores of years, you need to show that the law firms themselves purposefully directed activities at Hawaii. But if you were going to adopt a conspiracy theory of jurisdiction, the courts have really struggled to coalesce around the test, and I don't think that the courts have coalesced around the test. But for example, the Santa Fe case from New Mexico, the court said that you would need to have the knowledge and participation in the acts that impacted the state. And certainly nothing in this record shows the law firms having knowledge and participation in acts that would rise to the level of fraud impacting Hawaii.
Is it enough that the defendants knew that the products would be sold across the United States, including in Hawaii?
No, it is not, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First, it goes back to that's the stream of commerce theory that's been roundly rejected, going back to the J. McIntyre case in the U.S. Supreme Court, and this court, of course, in Shaw said foreseeability is insufficient. The second, merely selling product is not a fraud. You would need to show participation in acts that rise to the level of actionable fraud in Hawaii, knowledge and participation in those acts. And certainly, there's been nothing that's been said here.
What if the acts are the allegedly deceptive advertising? I mean, I think that's their theory. There were deceptive ads that the law firms were part of creating. Again, these are mere allegations. And that is enough. The knowledge that those ads would be shown in Hawaii is enough to make it fair to hail these firms into Hawaii. What's your response to that?
A couple of points, Your Honor. First, the allegations there go to a nationwide course of advertising. And nationwide conduct has been held to be insufficient under both this court's Six Flags decision, where you had Six Flags, of course, advertising their amusement parks nationally, and you had a Hawaii resident look on the website and talk to a travel agent in Hawaii about going to Six Flags. And this court said, no, that's nationwide conduct, that's insufficient. Again, in Shaw, well, this court eventually found jurisdiction, the court said that untargeted negligence that uniformly affects worldwide, used in that case, but same applies nationwide, is insufficient to create jurisdiction in Hawaii. So that would be the answer there. One point that it leads me to, though, is Your Honor said, well, if it was established, is there jurisdiction? And that leads into one of the points why some of the state Supreme Courts and some of the commentators say conspiracy jurisdiction essentially eviscerates due process, because it merges the liability question with the jurisdictional question. So when would that be established? That would not be established until trial, if ever. And if a defendant won the point that there was no conspiracy at trial, the defendant's got judgment on the merits, so doesn't care about jurisdiction. And if the client loses, then the harm has been done.
So, and that's why you suggest that there is no jurisdictional discovery. If we were to decide that there was conspiracy jurisdiction, you would say for that very reason, jurisdictional discovery is out of bounds because it's really just a merits-based discovery measure.
Right. And beyond the fact that jurisdictional discovery has never been requested at the circuit court, never been suggested at this court's level, they did attach all of those exhibits to their response that I've explained are insufficient to show any kind of jurisdiction.
Would in the conspiracy jurisdiction, the jurisdictions that have conspiracy jurisdiction, I mean, have they said anything about jurisdictional discovery that's just out of bounds for that very sort of double type of meaning, stalking horse type of meaning?
So I think that my recollection is correct, some of the cases, for example, that Nevada Supreme Court case said in a footnote, no, there's no reason for jurisdictional discovery. But I think Tennessee Supreme Court might have sent one back for jurisdictional discovery. Here, plaintiffs, as they say in their brief, have access to all of the manufacturer's documents, have been collected and produced and are on searchable databases, millions upon millions of documents. And they've been up there since, you know, 15, 20 years.
And you would say that, you know, in their opposition to your 12B2 motion, that's when they should have given the ammo, whatever they had.
That was their chance, yes, Your Honor. They're the ones, at that point, frankly, conspiracy jurisdiction was a very minor part of their opposition.
Well, didn't they bring it up in their opposition?
They did. They brought it up in their opposition, and they attached all those documents in order to both try to show traditional specific jurisdiction, which no court that has looked at this have said, oh, there's traditional specific jurisdiction. And then they also used it to attempt to show conspiracy jurisdiction. So with that, I see my light is on, so I reserve the rest.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Holden at this point.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please this court. It is an absolute pleasure to be in front of you today on behalf of respondents Marvin and Valerie Manius. Your Honors, the petition in this case rests on three myths. The first is that personal jurisdiction based on a conspiracy is somehow a novel legal theory. But in fact, the opposite is true. To date, there's six federal courts of appeal that either have adopted or recognized jurisdiction over a conspiracy, and no court of appeals have per se rejected it in a published opinion. And approximately 20 state courts have, again, adopted or at least recognized the theory. And over 10, in fact, I think it's 13 at this point, state Supreme Courts that have recognized jurisdiction based on a conspiracy. And many of these states have long-arm statutes that, just like Hawaii, are designed with the intent to reach as far as possible as the Due Process Clause will allow. The second myth is that conspiracy jurisdiction or conspiracy theory is somehow contrary to Supreme Court precedent. Chief Justice and Justice Edens, I think you recognize no cases so far have discussed that. No Supreme Court cases have discussed that. And in fact, they have language. The cases that were cited to you today, Walden, Bristol-Myers, some that were cited in the petition, they have language in there that says or shows that the Supreme Court would recognize conspiracy theory. And just last year, I believe, Justice Edens, you brought it up, the Supreme Court twice denied, not just once, twice denied cert on cases that were seeking to invalidate jurisdiction over based on a conspiracy. And finally, the third myth in this petition is that there's no evidence that the conspiracy specifically targeted Hawaii, that somehow the allegations, that the evidence do not show specific targeting of Hawaii. First, respondents aren't aware of any legal principle that a nationwide conspiracy that in fact does target individual states is therefore too big and must fail under personal jurisdiction law. And here, the allegations and the evidence demonstrate that Hawaii was in fact a target of this conspiracy. And despite the affidavits that were filed by the petitioners in the underlying case, not one of the petitioners' affidavits ever refuted the allegations of conspiracy, ever refuted that they targeted Hawaii. All they did was say, basically, they had no general jurisdiction here in this state because they had no office or presence here in this state. That was never a challenge by the respondents in this case. What we've shown through the allegations and specifically through the evidence here that we've provided is that there were ads that specifically targeted Hawaii. And I'll get into that in a minute. There was research that was suppressed here in Hawaii and that even physicians were misled here in Hawaii. And also evidence that the conspirators, in fact, they even met here, some of them. And implemented the conspiracy.
You know, how are those claims different from the stream of commerce idea? What you just said, the advertising, that's a national advertising campaign.
You have
how is there a direct target to Hawaii?
Well, you have specifically. So remember, this case is not just about the product itself. This is about the messaging with the product, the advertising, the misleading statements that were made to the people of Hawaii. And those statements become actionable where they are made. They were made here in Hawaii.
So is there just a giant jurisdictional bubble over these law firms everywhere in the U.S.?
No. There's jurisdiction where it can be proven either that the court has specific jurisdiction, as we argued in the underlying court, which Judge Kim did not approve of, or we can show, as we've done here, through conspiracy jurisdiction.
No, but I'm talking about your idea about the ads. I mean, ads targeted, the ads, I imagine, went out to every single state.
You did have to ads go to every single state, but you had specific ads for Hawaii. In fact, we attached one of the ads to our response, our opposition. It was a cool ad that said specifically the number one cigarette in Hawaii, the cigarette for Hawaiians, multiple statements that were directed to Hawaii. So it shows that wasn't a national ad that was just put out and somehow made its way into Hawaii. It was an ad that was specific to target Hawaiians here in Hawaiian publications, paid for in the Hawaiian publications and advertising space in Hawaii. It wasn't as though it was some national publication. But even if it was national, we know there's cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, such as the Keaton versus Hustler case. And it says that national distribution is a factor when it affects the people in the state. So even if it was just national, remember, this is not something, a stream of commerce where we say the product somehow got here. This is intentional misstatements of the qualities of this product that were specifically sent into the state, either by purchasing or placement in local publications, such as the ad that we've shown here, or when they go on national TV or national media in order to reach as many people as possible. I think one of the statistics was that over 50 million people had been exposed to their statements, and 8 out of 10 Americans had heard them and have been affected by them. And those were the statements, in their own words, that were shaped by the lawyers.
How did you show proof? Can you identify any specific exhibit that you proffered in response to the 12B2 motion that tied these law firms to that direct targeted advertising in Hawaii?
That specific, no. But I don't think we have to be that specific at a motion to dismiss stage. I have to show prima facie evidence that they were involved. And as well, you can't ignore the allegations either.
But where is the evidence that they were involved in that particular ad?
In that, well, we know that they were in charge of the Tobacco Institute. They were in charge of the Committee of Counsel. They were in charge of what was called the advertising code. And we know, based on their own language, not something that the respondents have pled or have argued, in the documents themselves, it talks about how they were in charge of clearing advertising and making sure that it complied with basically with the conspiracy. So this ad doesn't go to the public without one of these lawyers touching it, approving of it.
Isn't that just some a conclusory allegation that just because they might have counseled their clients in general, that somehow relates to direct targeting in Hawaii?
No, because it's not just general counseling. We know, and as Chief Justice recognized, they've exceeded the bounds of representation here. Here they are, co-conspirators. They know what's happening. The whole purpose of monitoring the statements, editing the statements, and making sure that the statements comply with basically the conspiratorial efforts of the other companies, or the companies and the other conspirators, is to make sure that when it reaches here, that it reaches Hawaii, regardless of whether it's a specific Hawaii targeted ad or if it's something in a national ad, is that it complies with the conspiracy.
You're arguing by inference, because this is the nature of how the advertising committee and the committee of counsel operated, that they must have been aware of this ad, or the procedures they set up it must have led to this ad. I'm trying to understand the level of connection that you believe the evidence shows.
No, you're right. It is based on, to a certain extent, on circumstantial evidence. And the Hawaii Supreme Courts have always said that circumstantial evidence is appropriate. In fact, one of the standard jury instructions that we have in the state is that the jury can rely on circumstantial evidence. I mean, surely very few conspiracies are going to have that smoking gun that ties everybody together to the conspiracy.
If we adopt this theory, though, then this means that you would be free to also sue like the advertising agencies. So we're going to be routinely bringing in all the law firms and the advertising agencies into Hawaii?
No, that's not true. if you can show that they were part of the conspiracy, if they had knowledge of the conspiracy, knowledge of the acts of their co-conspirators, and that they intended for the acts to ultimately be consummated in a forum like Hawaii, then yes, if you meet the requirements, you can pull in those companies. Now, we're not aware of evidence at this point that, you know, marketing agencies, and I think at the trial court level question was accounting firms and things like that. That's not part of our claims here. Here we have not only the allegations that are specific to these law firms, but we have evidence that backs that up, that we can show that they were. If you were to pick a threshold, you were to say a standard that should be adopted for conspiracy jurisdiction, well, you would say there's a conspiracy, the defendant was involved, and that there was an overt act taken inside the state in the forum that the defendant was aware of and somehow participated within the conspiracy. We have that here.
How do you establish that the law firms were aware and had a part in these ads? How do you establish that?
Their own documents. The evidence shows that. So their own documents show, ultimately, the documents show that they are in charge of what they call the health and smoking matter. That is the conspiracy. Of course,
so they're not acting just like a normal law firm, because ordinarily, if a client asks a lawyer, what about this ad? Wouldn't that be attorney-client privileged?
That would be attorney-client privileged, and that's different. That's seeking a lawyer's counsel or a law firm's advice on something. And then the client, as they said, the client may take the advice, may not take the advice. That's not what's happening here. When you see here, in fact, some of the documents here, and I think it's a Shook Hardy Bacon document, in fact says, are non-litigating responsibilities. And one of the things it talks about is clearing statements. So the question then is, well, if you're clearing statements, misstatements, fraudulent statements, where were they going to go? They know that they're being targeted to smokers across the United States. And we have evidence here that they know that the actions of the co-conspirators, not just the statements themselves, but the actions of the co-conspirators, in addition to those advertisements, are targeting Hawaii.
And clearing statements for what purpose again?
Excuse me?
For what purpose were they clearing the statements?
To make sure that they were in compliance with the smoking and health matter. In other words, the conspiracy. To make sure none of the conspirators were out of line. In fact, there's an example of one advertisement that was going to go out, and ultimately it gets killed by one of the lawyers. He says, well, we can't say that in an advertisement. You got to either pull that section of the advertisement or get rid of it. And it's our belief that that advertisement never gets published because the lawyer specifically said you'd be revealing part of this fraud. So that's sufficient. And there's other evidence too. It's not just as though, you know, we have the advertising itself. I mean, of course, that's very strong. And again, this is the
follow up on Justice Edmonds' question about, you know, in essence, a bubble across the United States. Would it be your position that any state in which these ads ran would have personal jurisdiction over the law firms on a conspiracy theory?
If you can show that the conspiratorial acts were targeted at that specific state and that these lawyers knew about it, and they were involved to some extent.
Is it enough to show that the lawyers knew that there were ads running in a state, or do they have to have specific ads that are specific to that state? In other words, I think I heard you say that you didn't think the Hawaii ad itself was critical. So is it just that lawyers knew there were ads running in these states, and whatever states the ads ran in, that's enough?
If there are fraudulent misstatements in those ads, and they're involved in those fraudulent statements, yes. One of the comments that was made earlier by opposing counsel is that under the Six Flags, the Norris versus Six Flags, that somehow advertising can't be a basis. That's not true, because the Norris case recognizes in Cohen, another Supreme Court case here, that advertising is relevant. There is a relevancy there. And in Norris, the case that sort of says that it's not relying on the advertising, the claims there weren't based on the advertising. Here, the claims are based in part on the advertising. The misstatement was made in the advertisement, and the statements that were being made in addition to the advertising. And not only that, but you also have, we attach another document that we attach is early on, going all the way back to 1959, early in the conspiracy, where a physician from the Hawaiian Sugar Planters Association is writing back to them and thanking them for sending the doctor materials. And he says, you've provided great comfort to one of my smokers who thought that his... I think it was an amputation or an injury that the gentleman had. Now he feels much better that it wasn't caused by smoking. Thank you for the report that you sent me. In another instance,
Mr. Holden, As I understand it, the conspiracy that you are alleging is among the law firms in their effort to conceal and misrepresent the harms and addictive nature of smoking, among other things. So it's the health aspect of smoking that allegedly was a fraud that was perpetrated on the public through these law firms.
Yes. Okay.
Now, what you're talking about here on the marketing seems to me, I don't see where in that marketing saying that, you know, Kools are the best cigarettes for Hawaii, where there's a targeted a targeting of that conspiracy by the law firms. It seems to me it's plain advertising saying our product is the best product, but it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the concealing or misrepresentation about the health effects of smoking.
Well, it does. For example, I have a copy of it here. The Kool advertisement that we're talking about that specifically targets Hawaii. Not only does it target Hawaii and specifically mention Hawaiians, but it also talks about super light cigarettes, low tar cigarettes, filter kings, milds. Those are all part of the fraud. Those are intended to entice individuals to think they are smoking a safe cigarette. The cigarette has a filter on it, therefore it's filtering, it's keeping me safe, or it's a mild cigarette or a low tar cigarette. In fact, it has numbers from the FTC here, which the FTC ultimately withdrew and said those were all deceptive. And we know that from their internal documents that those numbers are all deceptive. That's part of the fraud. So there's fraud in this advertisement to entice Hawaiians and residents of Hawaii to continue smoking these products at a time when the rising health consequences of smoking was increasing. So we do have that in the advertising itself. But that's not the only part, not just the advertising itself. And that's what I was getting into. You also have here in the state, they came to the University of Hawaii. And they tried, or they manipulated, and you can see the documents we've cited.
Can you tell
to
me who they is?
The lawyers.
Which lawyers?
So you have, in that instance, you have some Shirk-Hardy Bacon documents, and you have other documents that refer to the lawyers that are involved. So, and it's a handful of about five or six documents. That's one of the things. A lot of these, again, it's circumstantial evidence. You don't have one smoking gun. You have many documents that you have to go through. But ultimately, what you see there is there was Hawaii research that was going to research individuals here, actual Hawaiians, Caucasians, Japanese populations. And ultimately that research is killed because in the words of the lawyers, they would not have gotten a benefit from it. So that's ultimately the Hawaiian people have suffered as a result of that. So you have situations like that. You have, in addition, you have we've talked about the Tobacco Institute. That is a front. That was an entity that was created by the companies to basically keep this fraud going. And the Tobacco Institute then creates other entities, and the head of the Tobacco Institute is basically the lawyers. We know that from the internal documents. So something that was created on a local level, the Tobacco Action Network, was here. There is no question that they were not here. We have a memo that memorializes, or a letter that memorializes, and again, I believe this may be on Shirk-Hardy Bacon document, if not one of the other lawyers, that said, they were here in the 1980s. It was a successful meeting, and the plan is being implemented here. They're talking about the conspiracy. That's the whole point. That's the purpose of the creation of these entities, was for that purpose. So there is a sufficient amount of evidence that we've attached. And not only that, but they want us to prove our case at this point. We don't have to prove our case at this point. This is a motion to dismiss stage. We have to show prima facie evidence, and we've done that. And the court has to take our allegations as true and view it all in the light most favorable to us. And again, there is no affidavit filed by the petitioners that contradicts any of that information.
You say we have to take the allegations as true. Well, how is that? That seems sort of different from the argument that if we look at the documents, there's not enough evidence there. So which is it? We're bound by the complaint, or the court properly should have looked at the actual evidence put in front of it through the documents you submitted?
What's interesting, I think the Shaw case says that if there's no hearing, then the court looks at the papers. The papers here are the complaint and the affidavits and exhibits that were submitted. But again, when you're looking at those, the complaint, when you're looking at the documents that were submitted, the standard is still in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. and they must be taken as true. And even when they're controverted, which they weren't here, they weren't controverted. Even when they are, though, they must be taken in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. And when you look at all that together here, we've alleged that these law firms were central, not that they were just a part, that they were some kind of advisory role. They were, in fact, central. We have the internal documents that we put up that talk about them being in charge. Now, again, not just a part, but they were in charge of the health, the smoking and health situation. We have documents that say that they were doing the overall policy for the tobacco companies and implementing it on a day-to-day basis. They can't get any more involved than that. And if they want to argue about the sufficiency of that evidence going forward, that's an issue for perhaps summary judgment or at trial, but not necessarily at this stage. There's quite a bit that's been submitted here. And what I would say is that this court just last year said that the limits of due process have not been static, and that the long-arm statute allows the Hawaii courts to invoke personal jurisdiction to the full extent permitted by due process. It's not that we're seeking a plaintiff-friendly standard. This is the standard put here by the legislature, that the legislature has told us we are going to seek jurisdiction to the fullest extent possible with due process. And to date, there's no Supreme Court opinion that has said otherwise, and there's no indication that the Supreme Court would reject jurisdiction over a party to a civil conspiracy. In fact, it's the opposite. So to reject it here, based on the context of their co-conspirators, is to actually to go against the legislative intent on the statute, Your Honors. And going to Walden, speaking, because there was some discussion about Walden earlier, Walden does look at the relationship among the defendant, the forum, and the litigation. And it says the defendant's contacts, this is important, the defendant's contacts may be intertwined, not with just the plaintiff, but with other parties. And all they said there, the Supreme Court said, look, standing alone, just a relationship, that's not enough. You got to show something more. And we have that here. We've shown that not only are they conspirators, but we've shown their acts in furtherance of the conspiracy and how it targeted Hawaii. In fact, in Walden, the court explicitly said that minimum contacts or a defendant could create minimum contacts, not only through its own acts, but through that of an agent or some other means. So they left the door open there. And when you look at the Daimler case, in fact, the Daimler case, I believe, came out maybe a month or so before the Walden case. And there they said that the agency relationships are specific or are relevant to specific jurisdiction. They didn't say agency. They said agency relationships. That's important because it's expansive and it includes an agency relationship such as conspiracy among the defendants.
Counsel, you commented earlier, sir, about the central role of law firms. And with this case, that is we're focusing on law firms. And the question I have is, at what point, undoubtedly, the law firms are placed in a fiduciary duty to provide service to their clients, albeit the manufacturing companies, so be it. So undoubtedly, the relationship that the law firms and their clients have, at what framework, what point would you suggest to this court that they would not be subject to a conspiracy jurisdiction? It just seems endless with the description of anytime there's this relationship between a law firm in a duty to provide advice to their client, that they can be hauled into court.
Sure, that's not the case here. I understand what you're saying, and yes, and if they were just providing advice to their clients, letter opinion, some otherwise, discussing some of the efforts that the tobacco industry was taking, and then the tobacco industry did what they wanted with that advice, then I would agree with you. There would be no conspiracy jurisdiction because there is no conspiracy. That's what a lawyer is supposed to do. A lawyer is supposed to provide advice to his clients. In this case, we've not only alleged but shown that they went beyond that. They went beyond the attorney-client relationship to the point that they were, in fact, co-conspirators. When they know of the fraud, when they know that the tobacco industry, beginning in the 1950s, is denying the harms of smoking, and they're misleading individuals on the harms of smoking. And they know this. The law firms know this. The evidence is that they know this, and we've alleged that they know this. They have now transcended from an attorney-client relationship to acting in concert with the client, with the tobacco industry. They can no longer hide behind the attorney-client relationship and say, well, we were just providing advice to our client. When they go and they modify, edit, clear these statements that go out to the public, and when they tell them you can say certain things, you can't say certain things, because that would be detrimental to our position that smoking does not cause disease, that is a fraudulent act. That is the act of a co-conspirator. That's why you don't have to be concerned, you know, the chilling effect that they brought up here, you know, throughout the trial court and the petition here. That's not a concern that has to be taken with much weight here, because here you have, it's so overwhelming in this case. The actions of the fraudulent conduct, and it's been talked about in multiple publications, multiple opinions that talk about the actions of these individuals, of these firms, as well as the tobacco industry. But you don't have to be concerned. And in fact, in one of the earlier cases, it may have been Matsurua or perhaps the Kahala Royal case. Both of those said you treat a lawyer who commits fraud just like any other fraudulent person. There's no. They don't get some kind of some benefit because they are a lawyer. You treat them just like any other fraudster. So,
what about discovery? Is that something that you sought and were denied, or something that, and what do you think the approach should be in cases like this to allowing discovery on jurisdictional issues?
I think you can allow discovery on jurisdictional issues, just like any other situation where you would allow discovery on jurisdiction. We did not specifically ask for jurisdictional discovery. We did propound discovery in the trial court that was stayed, I believe, first by agreement and then ultimately by this court pending the petition. So there is going to be discovery, assuming we go forward, specific to these law firms. But to answer the specific question, did we say we can't respond to this motion to dismiss without discovery? No. We went forward with the information that we have thus far. That is sufficient to get us past the motion to dismiss stage. And I want to address just briefly why jurisdiction is reasonable and comports with fair play and substantial justice. When we look at the facts of this case, Hawaii is the only state with significant contacts of all the parties, not only the tobacco defendants, the plaintiffs here, and as well as the law firms. There's no other forum, not one other forum that can exercise jurisdiction over all the parties, which would ultimately force respondents, the maniuses, to seek justice, not only here in Hawaii on some parts of their claims, but in at least three other jurisdictions. That cannot be so. That is going to go to duplicative, time-consuming, and likely potentially inconsistent litigation, which the petitioners will take advantage of here. And Hawaii has a significant interest that's at stake. As Ford said, Hawaii wants to provide its residents with a convenient form for addressing injuries inflicted by out-of-state actors and enforcing its own laws. Here, it's laws against fraud, it's laws against conspiracy, it's laws against concealment. There is a very strong interest here in protecting individuals and providing a forum to individuals like the maniuses. And when we look at the flip side of this, the burden on the petitioners is low. They're all national and even international law firms. And in fact, Shook Hardy has already appeared in this case and others here in the state of Hawaii. So the strong interest that the state has here is not outweighed by the burdens on the defendant, on the petitioners. So,
counsel, what are your thoughts? Even amongst the states and the circuits, there is a difference in, if this court were to adopt conspiracy jurisdiction, there's a difference in defining what that means. And so wouldn't there be an equity to allow state A to bring in a law firm, but state B does not meet and satisfy that?
I don't think there is that much of a difference when you look at it, when you look in detail at these different states. I think what you have is a number of states that have recognized that conspiracy theory is viable, but what they say is that in a particular case, maybe the plaintiff went too far, the plaintiff tried to push too far. And they don't give you a very specific standard, but they say, for example, just the effects of a conspiracy in a state, I think we would agree as well, that's not enough. You have to show the overt act or the act that was a substantial step in furtherance of the conspiracy taking place in the forum. And we have that here. And we also have the fact that the petitioners, these law firms, knew that these steps were going to be taken in the forum. So that's a sufficiently concrete.
These steps, you're talking about the ads in general or the specific incidents of contacts with Hawaii, the cool ad, the doctorate from the plantation, the UH reach out?
I would say all of those. I wouldn't isolate any one of those. I would say every single one of those is important to the contacts analysis, to the jurisdictional analysis.
Is there evidence in the record to indicate these defendants were aware of those Hawaii-specific contacts, other than the inference? I asked you this in essence before.
Well, you have the inference, and then you have, at least with regards to the suppressing research at the University of Hawaii, we know that Shokardi Bacon was involved with that and is in parts of those correspondence dealing with that. And I believe Covington is part of that as well, but that's in the number of those documents. And as I said before, based on the inference that they were in charge of everything, including the advertising, specifically the advertising, then there's no way the inference can be made that there's no way that these advertisements get to Hawaii without at least one of these law firms clearing it, reviewing it, and approving it to come here into the state.
So the phrase "at least one" is that all that's necessary for the other ones? I mean, if you're not that one law firm, is that why are you being hauled in if you're not that one law firm?
Well, no, I just meant that in essence, we know the law firms are on there. We have an abundance of evidence otherwise, but for this one specific advertisement, the inference can be made circumstantially that we know that they were on it, that they were reviewing it, and they were looking at it. That's all I meant by that phrase. So if just to wrap up, Your Honors,
Let me ask you this, sir, circling back to that. You know, the Committee of Counsel has a lot of law firms. Are you saying you could bring them all in, not just these three?
Yes. Yes, because all those law firms, it isn't that many law firms, but the law firms that are involved, yes, we can bring them in because of the intimate nature, the intimate involvement of these law firms. And we've shown that here. We've shown, well, we've alleged it, and we've shown evidence that they were involved. Specifically, these law firms that are roles either suppressing research, involved in the misstatements that were going out to the public, not just advertisements. I want to make sure that we're not limiting it just to advertisements. It also includes misstatements made directly by tobacco industry executives, by Tobacco Institute executives, that were all being coached by these law firms. So yes, if we could show for the additional firms that may have been there, and there aren't that many, then yes, we could pull those in as well, Judge. And I would like to end just very briefly. 18 years ago, in one of the longest trials in U.S. history, a district court concluded in a racketeering case against the tobacco industry that these lawyers at every stage played an absolutely central role. And that's the United States versus Philip Morris USA in 2006. And the court concluded there, what a sad and disquieting chapter in the history of an honorable and often courageous profession. And fortunately for us all, this is only a chapter in history and not the status quo of this profession. The petitioners were here in Hawaii, acting through their co-conspirator agents, just as they would have been if they had hired agents to publish the same misrepresentations and conceal information in Hawaii. To hold that petitioners can't be held accountable in Hawaii under these facts is to frustrate the purpose of Hawaii law on fraud, conspiracy, and ultimately personal jurisdiction. So with that, the respondents respectfully request that the court deny the petition, find jurisdiction exist in this case, and remand the case back to the trial court for further proceedings.
Thank you, Mr. Holden.
Thank you.
Mr. Michael, your rebuttal.
Just to be clear, that statement from a district court judge was in a case where none of these law firms were parties, none of them had a chance to defend themselves. There's been a suggestion that, well, it's been known that these law firms were part of an alleged fraud, and why should we have to go to where the law firms are found? Well, plaintiffs have been suing tobacco companies for 70 years without suing the law firms. We have fraud claims at issue, which have joint and several liabilities, so plaintiffs would be completely compensated by recovering against the manufacturers. And we put into our briefing below, certainly, that these very plaintiffs' counsel have been suing tobacco companies without law firms for 15 years in the mainland. And the first personal injury tobacco case is going to trial next month in a case where these same plaintiffs' counsel did not sue the law firms. So there's no damage to fair play and justice being done by saying you can protect the law firm's personal jurisdiction liberty interests. Much of that argument was basically re-arguing specific jurisdiction by trying to show what plaintiffs have failed to show, what Judge Crabtree said did not exist, what Judge Ruiz said did not exist, and what Judge Kim certainly did not adopt, which is that the law firms themselves specifically came into Hawaii and did something.
Are the records in Judge Ruiz's and Judge Crabtree's case identical to this one?
Essentially, Your Honor, yes. There might be one or two different advertisements because the plaintiff smoked a different brand of cigarettes, but I think plaintiff in their own brief drops a footnote and says basically the records are all overlapping. So when we called them out for this in our reply brief, that they're overstating what the exhibits show by mixing and matching allegations and just unsupported assertions in a brief with the actual exhibits. So the exhibits that they're talking about suppressing research in Hawaii, those are exhibits P through U to exhibit 5 of our petition. What that shows is a researcher applied to someone at the tobacco industry for a research grant, and the research grant was denied. They're not going into Hawaii and suppressing, saying you need to stop this research, et cetera.
Referring to my previous question to Mr. Holden, the fraud that's, the conspiracy that's alleged is fraudulently concealing and misrepresenting the harms, addictive nature of smoking. Now, he is saying that this was a targeted fraud nationwide. So isn't that distinguishable from your stream of commerce? All right, this is not putting a product into the stream of commerce where it somehow reaches Hawaii. This is an affirmative fraud that's being alleged to have been perpetrated nationwide, and Hawaii is part of the nation. So isn't that a distinguishable situation? And if so, why shouldn't Hawaii have jurisdiction to allow a cause of action against the law firms?
I would say no, Your Honor. That's a distinction without a difference. The cases are clear that a nationwide course of conduct, what this court called untargeted negligence in Shaw, you can't just repackage it and say you're targeting everywhere. That's just untargeted negligence does not create jurisdiction. And plaintiff's theory would have jurisdiction over these law firms in every single state in America. And similarly, if a Hawaii law firm that never left Hawaii counseled someone on a nationwide advertising campaign, that Hawaii law firm would be subject to jurisdiction every single place in America. That's simply not what due process is meant to prevent. And I think he referenced the Shokardi document that listed non-litigation responsibilities. I don't have the cite for that, but if you look at it, it's just saying, here's what we do for the client. We monitor proposed legislation on product liability and we evaluate that act. And when he talks about clearing statements, there's certainly no evidence in this record that even the Hawaii specific ad or even any other ad had a lawyer looking at it, a specific Womble lawyer, Shook lawyer, or Covington lawyer looking at it and saying, no, don't run this ad, change it this way. There's nothing in the record.
So there is absolutely no tie with that Kool's ad targeting Hawaii with any of your clients?
Exactly, Your Honor.
What about his argument that that's a reasonable evidence from the state of what's been presented about this, you know, committee of lawyers and the different or entities which have been set up, in his view, to perpetrate the fraud? Again, those are mere allegations.
Right, I understand. And there's certainly nothing in the record to support that. There is no, you know, this Womble lawyer was in charge of reviewing Kool ads and saying, here's what the ad should say. There's nothing like that in the ads, in the evidence that's been proffered. The suggestion was made by Mr. Holden that, well, due process is not static. which this court, of course, commented on in the recent case. And I think the court was commenting on it to say, well, there might be occasion where due process changes in the U.S. Supreme Court's mind, and we don't agree with going that far. By the way,
and sorry to interject, because I know you were probably going to make a wonderful point, but since you brought it up, you know, 2 days ago there was a Supreme Court decision on this. You know, Justice Gorsuch seems to want to go back to 1868 and play tag, perhaps. What's your take? I mean, what do you think the impact of sort of that, let's call it, originalist thinking, we go back and the way things were back in 1868, which was just plain tag, what's the impact of that if the U.S. Supreme Court was going to tack that way?
So I did read that opinion, and nothing in it, I don't think.
It has nothing to do with our case. So, yeah, right. I understand.
And so let's say the Supreme Court scraps international shoe and the whole project.
Shoe doesn't fit anymore. Huh?
The question is, I still think the question is, could a defendant have reasonably anticipated being hailed into that court? And whatever other test you're going to make up, it comes back to that basic question. So what's been said here is, if it's static and this court adopts a major and novel expansion, as Judge Crabtree said, of conspiracy jurisdiction, then how could these law firms back in 1960 through 1990, when these allegations are, have been reasonably anticipating that sometime in 2023, this court would expand due process to cover conspiracy jurisdiction? I mean, typically when a major expansion like that happens, the court would say, well, under due process, it's got to be prospective only if it was expanding a criminal statute or something like that. But so I do think even if, you know, Gorsuch has his way, we would still prevail. I'd see my time's up. I would just end by bringing it back to this court's statement in Doe that restrictions on a court's personal jurisdiction are more than a guarantee of immunity from inconvenient or distant litigation, although this litigation would certainly be inconvenient and distant for these law firms, but they're a consequence of territorial limitations on the power of their respective states. And those limitations are meant to protect the defendant's due process, liberty, interests. And we respectfully submit that conspiracy jurisdiction will be a major and novel expansion of jurisdiction in violation of those due process rights. So it asks that the court issue the writ.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'o malalo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolo kolo ki ike hanohano. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.